You were listening to a session recorded live at the American Society of Safety Engineers Safety 2011, held June 12th through the 15th in Chicago, Illinois. Now to our session.
Well, good morning, everybody. And we're here for the delivering safety at heights at the workplace, which starts in right now. I'm the moderator. My name is Richard Dresser. On behalf of the American Society of Safety Engineers, welcome to this session, Delivering Safety at Heights at the Workplace. The session is brought to you by the Standards Development Committee and the Engineering Specialty Practices. Please note the following. In case of emergency, an audible and or visual alarm will sound, and we'll ask you to evacuate the room in an orderly fashion and proceed to the nearest exit until all clear is sounded, and the exits are right out that way, out this door. Please note there is no smoking allowed in the conference or in the exposition spaces, and this must seem like an old re-recording to you who've been here. Please place all pagers and cell phones in a silent condition. As an added note, ASSC evaluations are now electronic. Fill out your evaluation forms on your laptop or web-enabled mobile devices at the end of each day. You can also complete your evaluations directly through SafetyNet and at any of the ASSC Safety 2011 cyber centers set up throughout the center. Thanks for your attention, ladies and gentlemen. And now, will you please join me in welcoming our speaker, Lori H. McCarley, Vice President of PMI Vertical Rescue Solutions from Denver. And I have a gift, a book about Chicago for her consideration.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Thank you.
And thanks, y'all, for being here this morning. We are going to talk about safety at height. We're going to talk a little bit about fall protection and some different methods of fall protection and some different options in protecting ourselves when working at height. I'd like to thank all you guys for being here this morning. I know it's pretty early. The cool thing about being here at 7:45 in the morning is that I know you're committed to your work. If you got up and came here at 7:45 in the morning to talk about fall protection, then obviously you're really committed. So I love to see that. And as I talk today, I would just request that if you have any questions or want to stop me at any point to talk about anything in the presentation, please stop me during the presentation. We'll have time for questions afterwards. But sometimes it's easier to ask questions and address things as we go along and as we touch on them so that we stay within context. Good to go? My name is Louie McCurley, and I am vice president of a company called Pigeon Mountain Industries. Pigeon Mountain Industries, PMI, makes life safety rope and equipment for safety at height. We actually are a rescue company by history. We've historically come to fall protection kind of through the after-the-fall issue. And have come into fall protection through something called rope access. Rope access is an alternative method for safety at height and for protecting people while they're working at height. And we use methods similar to rope access in rescue a lot. I actually sit on the ANSI Z359 committee as well as the A10 tower portion of the construction committee. On an ISO committee for fall protection. So I work a lot in committee work and trying to align the kinds of work that we do in the field and the equipment that we use in the field with the standards that are being written. I come from a very field perspective. My mindset is very hands-on. I'm a trainer with Vertical Rescue Solutions. I teach people for a living. I do rope access. I started out in rope access myself, working at height for a living. So I come at these things from a very, very practical perspective, and I'm fortunate to sit on some of the standards writing committees as well. So if you have any questions in those regards as we go, again, don't hesitate to ask. Again, we're here to talk about falls. We're here to talk about falls because falls are a really big deal. Falls have been a really big deal for certainly as long as I've been in industry. They cost the workplace a whole lot of money every year. They kill a whole lot of people every year. In fact, 2.2 million deaths worldwide are reported every single year due to falls. And they actually account for about 12% of all fatal occupational injuries. Falls have remained in the top three categories of workplace injuries and fatalities, again, for about as long as I can remember. We're going to discuss some of the reasons for that and maybe discuss some different mindsets and approaches that we can take towards changing that fact. It's not that our safety directors and our safety personnel aren't thinking about safety. They absolutely are thinking about safety. The problem is they're thinking about a lot of other things at the same time. They're thinking about bringing in a project on budget, on time. They're thinking about environmental considerations. They're thinking they have a lot of things to balance in the process. And, of course, they have to think about regulatory compliance as well. We're going to talk about regulatory compliance and how it's kind of helped us in some ways, but maybe it's also created some stumbling blocks for us that we may need to consider as well. You're all familiar with OSHA. OSHA was created by Congress to try to prevent workplace injuries and fatalities, and actually, OSHA has succeeded in preventing workplace injuries and fatalities. In fact, occupational deaths have been cut by 62% since the inception of OSHA. That's a pretty big deal. That's a really awesome deal. Unfortunately, we're not seeing that trend in falls. OSHA promulgates standards, as you well know. They promulgate standards for fall protection in both the general industry and the construction side of the house. There are specific standards requirements or regulatory requirements for different kinds of work being done at height and for different environments in which we're doing that work. That extends across, again, both general industry and construction, and I would contend that perhaps this is one area where we've created a stumbling block for ourselves with regulatory requirements. It's so confusing and so complex that people often don't know what it is they're trying to achieve or meet, what requirements they're trying to meet. Fortunately, according to sources at OSHA, it seems that OSHA recognizes this and are on a path with their new regulatory requirements, at least in the general industry, to try to correct that and try to streamline things a little bit. In the meantime, we have to meet their regulations. Again, when we're meeting their regulations, we are given some guidance towards meeting OSHA regulations by industry standards. ANSI, ASTM, NFPA, various organizations write standards to provide guidance towards achieving regulatory compliance. That can be helpful. Again, it can also create some confusion and lend to confusion. So as we approach the whole fall protection world, we have to realize the context that we're coming to it from. We're coming to it from a desire to keep people safe, but also a desire to keep our organizations safe in compliance. So with that in mind, we have to wonder, why do falls continue to dominate the workplace? This chart's pretty interesting. It shows that from 1992 to 2004, we averaged about 213 fatal falls from height. That's a lot of fatal falls from height. And in 2007, it wasn't any better. Now, what's up with that? We continue to see accidents like this. These guys were fully in compliance. They're wearing fall protection. They're doing all the things they're supposed to do. These workers were actually rescued by a fire department in about an hour, which is a whole other subject that we're not going to go into today, but is a problem. This is another incident. This one did not result in a death. This was just a fall from a bucket truck, serious injury. This was a fatal fall. This was a tower accident. A young man, a mere 28 years old, fell to his death from this tower. He was wearing fall protection equipment. This was an accident that happened with a 20-foot fall. 20 feet doesn't seem like a very long distance, and you probably jumped off things that were 20 feet when you were about 15 years old. But this one killed this gentleman. Yes, sir?
On the tower one, was he free climbing when he
fell? He was not connected when he fell, yes. But he was wearing fall protection equipment. And that is one of the struggles that we have in the tower industry is that there is the Gannett variance, which allows you to climb, and as long as you're in motion, there is some provision that you don't have to be tied off until you stop to work. And that is, again, a problem. But it's a problem that is actually the foundation of what we're going to talk about today. Because The Gannett variance was created because it's impractical to climb. It's impractical to constantly be connecting and using your twin lanyards to re-hook up, and it's a lot of work, it's a lot of energy, it's a lot of time. And so we make exclusions to the standards for certain classifications or groups of people. And it's in the exclusions, again, that we see fatalities and accidents. This was an accident, 70-foot fall. This was a fatal fall. My point here is not so much to tug at your heartstrings as it is to point out the falls are still happening, and they're happening across a broad range of industries, and they're happening to a lot of different kinds of people who should be and often are dressed in some form of fall protection. You've probably seen this study or some of the studies by Wong and Hines. They've done some phenomenal studies in fall protection over the years, and this is a really interesting one. When we look at fall protection data, unfortunately, we tend to look several years behind where we are today, and the reason for that is simply because of what it takes to gather data. But this was a study that looked at falls that occurred between 1990 and 2001. They took a selected about 3,000 fall accidents that were OSHA investigated, and what they found in this study, among other things, was that about 30% of the falls were attributable to inadequate, inappropriate, or complete lack of personal fall protection. Now, what's up with that? We just talked about the standards and how all the standards are promulgating the use of equipment, and the standards are bringing better equipment unto light, and yet we find that 30% of these falls are because PPE isn't being used. The other thing that was significant about this study is that there wasn't any improvement to the data since the 1996 revision by OSHA to the PPE regulations. In fact, what we find time after time is that falls continue to dominate workplace injury and fatality statistics simply because fall protection is not always feasible as it's defined by OSHA and regulatory requirements. Equipment is improperly used, or perhaps not used at all. And then we also have a failure to rescue. We're going to focus on those first two points today. You may have heard me here speak at the conference before about the failure to rescue and the problems that we have in that regard, and I'm not going to really touch on that today, although it is a significant problem. But I am going to touch on the first two bullet points primarily, where we're going to talk about the infeasibility of fall protection. And if you look at the OSHA statistics and the OSHA fatal facts, you see that one of the reasons that's often given for someone not using fall protection, someone free climbing a tower, someone not being hooked up at the time, was because fall protection was infeasible at that moment or during that kind of work. You also find that equipment is not used properly much of the time. I mentioned earlier that I sit on the ANSI Z359 committee. ANSI Z359 is the general industry standard for fall protection. It covers a broad range of types of fall protection, and in fact, it's no longer just ANSI Z359.1. You guys probably know that by now. ANSI Z359.1 is actually being replaced by numerous very specific standards that are directed at the type of work that you're doing, whether it's fall arrest or positioning, restraint, and then there's also a section on rescue. There's another dozen chapters in addition to this one, which may sound confusing, but if you consider the fact that each of the chapters is focused on a specific type of work, not an industry, not shipyard is different from rail yard, but type of work like fall arrest, positioning, restraint, rope access, etc. What we're going to focus on today, I want to talk to you about ANSI Z359.2. ANSI Z359.2 is your roadmap to creating a managed fall protection program. In fact, that's its title, is the ANSI managed fall, comprehensive managed fall protection program. The comprehensive managed fall protection program is literally a step-by-step guide that goes through the process of how to select what kinds of systems that you need for fall protection and what things that you need to think about in regard to whatever it is that you choose. ANSI Z359.2 starts with a policy statement. A policy statement is essentially your organization's statement that says, our safety policy is, fill in the blank. Usually companies say that their safety policy is to take some sort of precautions towards preventing accidents from happening in the first place, and then guarding against those falls in the first place and then recovering from those falls should they happen anyway. There's usually, or there should be, an employer-designated program administrator for your fall protection program. The NCZ 359.2 Comprehensive Managed Fall Protection Program Guide actually goes through this whole process, and this is the place where it starts. The second place it goes is to the Fall Hazard Survey. Anytime you have any kind of work happening at height, you should do a Fall Hazard Survey. The Fall Hazard Survey should address and it should take into consideration any kinds of hazards that might exist with details, with descriptions of the type of work that's being performed while the person is in hazard. We need to talk about the number of people who are exposed, either simultaneously or consecutively. The number of people that might be available to respond should an accident happen. We want to talk about the height of the fall plus any potential obstructions that might be in the way, because obstructions are a really big deal. The environment can create a hazard or a problem, whether it's axle grease or weather. Any of those things can create a problem, and you need to note those environmental considerations. And then another important thing to look at is any history of accidents that have occurred in that area or that type of area in your facility in the past. The Fall Hazard Survey is your groundwork. It's your map towards protecting the falls. Once you can't really protect against falls unless you identify the specific hazards that are a problem. Handing your guys a harness and a lanyard is not going to do the trick. They need to know, you need to know, where they're going to connect that lanyard and what they're going to do with it and what they're going to be protecting against so that they don't get themselves into further problems. The next step, once we've identified our hazards, is to mitigate the hazards. There's multiple ways to mitigate the hazards. Our first choice is to eliminate the hazard altogether. Our first choice is not to let the accident happen or the potential fall happen. The second way that we like to, that we prefer to protect against falls is through passive fall protection. Passive fall protection is where the hazardous work practice is isolated from the employees. So we try not to, we put them on in a guardrail, for example, or on a leash. Positioning is a system that you can't fall more than 2 feet. It keeps you from actually ever entering a significant fall hazard. Rope access is a system that is a dual rope system where it's completely interchangeable and allows the person to travel on rope instead of on the structure. Restraint is, for example, you see a lot of restraint on sloped roofs. Sloped roofs are a good use of restraint systems. And then fall arrest is kind of our least desirable method of fall protection. If you can't protect the fall using one of these methods, it's probably best that you try to avoid the work altogether. If you can't avoid the work altogether, there is something called administrative controls that you are allowed to use. They're not recommended because they're not nearly as protective as any of these other methods. Fall protection systems that we normally see consist of things like guardrail systems, safety nets, fall arrest systems, including positioning and travel restraint, and then the safe work practices and training is considered a method of fall protection. Those are the kinds of systems that we normally see that are commonly used. But unfortunately, those are the kinds of systems that we often hear people say, sorry, fall protection was infeasible in this situation. I didn't have anywhere to anchor. I didn't have anywhere to clip in. I was on a leading edge, and I was unable to protect myself. And that's where the accidents happen. Things like this. Things like this are very difficult to protect. Although it's in compliance, this is an accident waiting to happen. Here's another situation that's very difficult to protect. We need to do this kind of work. There's work being done. But again, the type of fall protection is not typical to the kinds of things that we see defined by ANSI and OSHA. And of course, towers, we know, are a constant issue because of the fact that you can't start at the top. You have to go up before you can come down. And then these are another situation. Wind turbines are an area where we've really run into some new problems. And the new problems that we've run into have to do with needing to access both the inside and the outside for maintenance. But they've also had to do with the fact that a lot of these turbines are built to European specifications and they don't meet U.S. standards. Again, that's a topic we're not going to delve into too deeply today, but it is something to be aware of. So this is where rope access comes in, and this is one of the things I want to really talk to you guys about today as an alternative for fall protection. Rope access is defined by ANSI Z359 as a method of access using safety ropes, normally incorporating two separately anchored systems, one as a primary, the other as a secondary. Usually in a rope access system, the two systems are completely interchangeable. So at this moment, my primary might be this one and my secondary might be this one, but at any point I can change over and make this my primary and this my secondary. You'll see through some examples and a little later on why that can be important and how it lends to safety. Rope access allows ascending, descending, horizontal traverse, as well as suspension at the place of work. We consider rope access to be somewhere in the neighborhood of restraint as far as the hierarchy of control. Everybody familiar with this little diagram? The hierarchy of control? The hierarchy of control, the top is bad, bottom is good. So we want to eliminate, as we talked about earlier, we want to eliminate the potential for a fall. That's where we start. We want passive protection, something that a person doesn't have to be trained to, something that he doesn't have to be wearing special equipment for. Those are our primary goals for fall protection. When we can't get there, we move into the restraint, rope access, fall arrest, and eventually administrative control methods of fall protection. Rope access, as I said, fits somewhere in the neighborhood of restraint. This is avoidance. You guys are all familiar with this kind of thing. This is restraint. That's positioning. And that's arrest. So those are what we call conventional fall protection. Those are the kinds of things that you see every day out in the field. Avoidance, restraint, positioning, and arrest. Those are very, very common methods. The method of rope access is actually not really neatly fit into any of those. It's a dual rope system, completely redundant, completely interchangeable. It permits ascending, descending, horizontal movement. It accommodates self-rescue, which is a really big deal as far as I'm concerned. And it accommodates partner rescue through the use of simple pre-trained techniques. It's a complete system of work. When you use rope access, it's more than your 8 hours of training for the authorized person and hand him a harness and let him go to work. Rope access does not work that way. Rope access requires trained, certified workers, usually a minimum of 40 hours training before they ever go on the job site. There has to be a comprehensive pre-plan for how everything's going to work, how the access is going to happen, how the post-fall protection is going to happen. But in the end, rope access provides limited fall protection. Again, in fall arrest, we can take up to a 6-foot fall. In rope access, you never get yourself into that predicament. Rope access allows frontal attachment points on your harness, which is conducive to the interchangeability as well as the rescue systems, and it allows a great deal of versatility and redundancy. I want to point out that rope access is not synonymous with a lot of the things that we think it's synonymous with. It's not synonymous with window cleaning. It's not synonymous with steeplejacking. It's not synonymous with mountain climbing. It's not synonymous with rope descent systems or RDS or controlled descent. Those are all very different things from rope access. Rope access is a very different beast, but it is used in all of these fields, including structural inspections, construction, bridges, wind turbines, geotech, surveying. It's used in a broad range of industries. It's not industry specific. Rope access is used around the world. It's not unique to the United States, and it's certainly not new. It's been in existence in the United States since the early 1900s, as far as we know. The Hoover Dam was built using rope access, and to this day, the Bureau of Reclamation uses rope access to do most of its inspections on bridges and dams throughout the country. So, key points. Certified technicians. Safe work practices. Rope is your primary support. You're connected to a secondary, interchangeable backup system, and you can go up, down, across, or be suspended at the place of work. These are kind of the key elements of what rope access is. And what we find is that rope access solves some of those problems that we were talking about earlier. It makes protection more feasible. It promotes the proper use of equipment, and it facilitates rescue. And I'm going to show you how it does those things. Here's an example on the Seattle Space Needle. This was a job done by RopeWorks a couple of years ago. The Seattle Space Needle was built a very long time ago and had never had a bath. They were able to give this the Space Needle a bath. They cleaned it pressure washed it and actually examined it in a course of about 7 weeks. And it only took 5 technicians to do it. They were in 100% fall protection all the time, work that was otherwise virtually impossible. Erecting a scaffold, having a lift system, other methods of fall protection simply could not be used. And these guys were able to do it not only safely, but quickly as well. 1962 was the year it was built. So this was the first time that it ever actually had a really thorough inspection as well. Here's another thing that Rope Access does fairly frequently. Wind turbine inspection and repair, Rope Access is really the only way to do this effectively and efficiently. You can do 6 to 9 blades per day. I mean, that you can check 6 to 9 blades per day using Rope Access techniques. Compare that to 2 to 3 blades per day using conventional methods. And again, using Rope Access techniques, you're in constant fall protection. You're in constant suspension, and much safer than the other methods that are out there. The other thing that you find is that Rope Access can be used in very windy environments because of the versatility, because of the redundancy, and again, because of the trained technicians. These turbines are seldom built in good weather neighborhoods. They're usually built in places that are selected for high wind, and we find that they're very effective for guys on rope. Outside isn't the only place that we work on turbines. This is inside a turbine, and behind this bus bar is all the cables and electronics stuff that goes with the turbine. And the ladder is usually, although not always, it's usually mounted right next to that system, but you really can't reach it from the ladder. If you had to do that work from the ladder, you'd hook your leg through and kind of stand there and lean out like this, and it really would not be the safest or most effective way of doing the work. Using Rope Access, we're able to descend down right next to the bus bar and do the work. This is one of the things that that dual rope system really lends itself to. Rope-to-rope transfer is a method of moving horizontally across a series of multiple ropes, and you can move entirely around or across a structure using different lines, just moving from one set to another, never being in anything less than 2 points of connection. This is another method called aid climbing. Aiding is a method of moving across a structure where nothing exists at all, and you plant the system, you plant the anchors as you go. Again, moving from one to the other and never being in less than 2, often in 3, points of connection at all times. It allows you to do jobs like this that would otherwise be very complex, very expensive, very difficult to do. Getting a bucket truck into the inside of a racetrack stand is a really difficult thing to do. This allows the work to be done in a relatively short period of time in a very effective manner. This is a job that was also where these kinds of techniques were also used. The horizontal traversing techniques were used for the Crescent City Connection in New Orleans. These are 2 bridges. I don't know if some of you guys may have actually been on these bridges. They're 1,500 feet long, so they're really long bridges, and they're about 230 feet off the deck at their highest point. These 2 bridges had never had a thorough point-to-point inspection, and this project took less than 2 months to complete, but every inch of that bridge, or both of those bridges, was scoured in less than 2 months. At no time during that project was the road ever closed. There was a lane shut down from time to time to allow guys to get in and out of trucks, but that's about it. So, those kinds of horizontal methods, as well as deviations or re-anchor systems. You see where his main anchor is up to the right and he's come down to an anchor off to the left. This is one of the systems that the Bureau of Reclamation uses for their dam inspections. It allows you to anchor at one point, have a secondary anchor at another point, and always protect yourself from horizontal swing or pendulum. Again, always a minimum of 2 points of attachment. Lead climbing, that's another technique that was used on those bridges and is often used on odd-shaped buildings. Lead climbing is a method where you have to place your protection as you go. You're on a leading edge. This is the only place that you're ever potentially in a fall hazard. As you can see from the way the upper guy is climbing, he's probably in about a 10-foot or more fall hazard at that point. So it is more than the 6-foot fall. But he's on something that we call a dynamic rope. The dynamic rope reduces your impact force to around 8 to 10 kilonewtons, depending on the rope that you're using, and allows you to climb beyond any leading edge or beyond your anchor points.
Question.
Yes, sir.
On a tower?
Yes, sir.
Does that mean that the first guy climbing up here can be attached at all times until he sets something for the other guys?
It does. It means that he's in more than a 6-foot fall potential from time to time, but he's always protected. So, having a 10-foot fall is better than grounding out. And in fact, I've taken up to 20-foot falls recreationally and not had any injury at all. So this kind of work can be done very effectively and protect areas that are otherwise unprotectable. It usually is a full-body harness in the professional world. Actually, it's another thing we're not going to touch on much today. But when you're climbing and when you're falling and when you're moving on a structure, there is some debate as to what the best point of attachment is. The dorsal attachment is the common one that we use for fall protection. We tend to use our dorsal attachment to clip our fall arrest system into. And when we fall in that dorsal attachment, the force absorber rips out and we have a nice soft landing. Not really, but that's the theory. When you're attached on a dorsal attachment, I don't know if any of you guys have ever taken a fall for real, but in a dorsal attachment, or in any attachment for that matter, when we're working on a structure, we tend to fall down. We tend not to step off of things nice and neat. We tend to take a head-over-heels type fall or trip. When we trip, we get into a head-down configuration. Our center of gravity is about, depending on whether you're male or female, somewhere between here and here. When you're attached here, that puts the vast majority of your weight below the center of gravity, which means that when you take a head-down fall, you have a really fun pendulum effect that happens. It's kind of more of a whiplash effect than a pendulum effect, and it can actually be really damaging to your body. It's actually better on the front. Most of our body weight, for most of us, is carried in front of us rather than in back of us. So when we have that dorsal attachment back there, our weight is not only below, our center of gravity is not only below the attachment point, it's well in front of the attachment point. The closer you can put that harness attachment point to somewhere between your xiphoid process and your belly button, the better off you're going to be. We don't recognize that or acknowledge that in regulatory or standards world yet. But in rope access, we always use a frontal attachment point, not just because of the safety for falling, because we're really not falling all that far, but mostly because of the interchangeability and your ability to double-check and clip in and clip out and be able to see your own system. Here's an example where lead climbing can be used either horizontally or vertically. This is actually on that same dam structure. So the sternal attachment permits versatility. As I said, you can change in and out of systems pretty quickly, pretty easily. You can check your own safety system. It allows you to set your systems tight enough and short enough. Your fall protection lanyards can be shorter here than they need to be if you're back here and can't see them and are working behind you. So it allows that lanyard to be a lot shorter, which limits your potential fall distance. Your suspension trauma or suspension intolerance, anybody familiar with that? We're going to talk about that a little bit later on. It helps you avoid that problem or those problems. And it facilitates the ability to do multiple methods in multiple kinds of systems, which means we can move from typical conventional fall arrest or fall protection in and out of rope access, constantly interchanging. This kind of thing allows us to reach the difficult nooks and crannies because we're attached in the front and not the back. Everything's in front of us, and it actually allows us to work in front and not be dangling out like Superman. This is a situation in Nevada, the Hoover Bypass, which was completed not too long ago. This is a concrete deck arch bridge. If you haven't been on it yet, it's beautiful. Take the trip. It's really worth it. It's about 900 feet above the Colorado River, and it only took 2 weeks to do the full inspection. Yes, sir, it is. Yeah. In this case, the rope access techniques were used alongside the snooper trucks because there were places that were safer and more controlled to do by snooper truck, and there were places that the snooper couldn't get to. So this was a good example of interchangeability and duplicate types of work happening at the same time. That dual rope system we've talked about before, but it allows us to use the equipment more safely and effectively. This is rockfall mitigation. This particular situation was at Spirit Lake. This is up above Mount St. Helens, and or below Mount St. Helens, actually. And they had to replace the rockfall mesh and then shotcrete the whole thing. And this was all done using rope access techniques. Again, had to be flown in by helicopter every day. There's really no other way to get into this site. So any other method of fall protection, any other method of doing the work would have been virtually impossible. This is another situation where rope access is used to do rockfall mitigation. This was in North Carolina, and it was after a catastrophic event. Again, bringing in any other kind of method or system to do the work would have been much less safe. This gave the guys a lot more versatility and the ability to hang gear on separate systems as well to build a containment fence to keep rocks from further falling. You often see this kind of work being used for building maintenance. I said it's not the same thing as window cleaning, and it's not the same thing as window cleaning. It's very different techniques, very different methodologies and mindset, although it looks a little similar because they both use ropes. This is a situation on a building where this building would be virtually impossible to do any other way. And you're probably well familiar with this building in New York City. Vertical Access Technologies did this job. They're an investigation, an engineering firm, completely went through the entire building doing surveying of the building to make sure that it was not falling apart. And then that front attachment point, I told you we weren't going to talk about this too much, and we're not, but I do want to mention that it does facilitate prompt rescue. Prompt rescue is a really big deal in some environments more than others, but in oil platforms especially. Oil platforms are a place where, again, usually not in good weather areas, usually a lot of wind, salt water, yucky stuff, and you really can't go down. If anything does happen or anything bad does happen, you're not going to descend out of your system. You're going to have to come back up. So being able to self-rescue or buddy rescue in a situation like this, rather than waiting for the nearest helicopter to come in, is a much more efficient and effective method of doing the work. Rope access also allows you to set strange systems in place and rebuild systems and put antennas in and things like that to places that are otherwise very difficult to reach. Rope access technicians are all trained in buddy rescue as well as self-rescue. And anything that a rope access technician can do, he can also rescue himself from, and he can also rescue a partner from. So that post-fall rescue issue doesn't become a problem. I mentioned we were going to talk about suspension intolerance or suspension trauma. There's a little debate going on right now as to whether suspension trauma is real. Suspension trauma first came to the public awareness probably 15, 20 years ago, when the French EDF did some research, and a lot of the groundwork was done in France. They did determine that that hanging suspended for periods of time, motionless in a harness, can be really, really bad for your health. A guy in England picked up on this about 10 years ago, and he wrote a paper about it, and he kind of researched a lot of the data that had been collected to that date, and published that data. That was Paul Seddon. He published that data in the early 2000s, and he encouraged people to be thinking about suspension trauma. We do see that people actually do die hanging, waiting for a rescue in harness. It's actually happened here in the United States. It's happened in other countries. It's not frequent. It's not often, but it does happen. Nina Turner and some other people did some work here in the United States just in 2008, supporting the same conclusions, that hanging motionless, suspended in a harness can be really, really bad for your health. Here's an accident that I came across here in the United States that was an OSHA-reported accident. I don't know how I found this, to be honest with you, because it wasn't reported as a fall accident, and fall accidents are really the only ones I look at. And this was classified as an asphyxiation death. So I don't know what all else is out there, but it really drove home for me that perhaps there's things happening there that we just don't have the right SIC codes for, and so therefore we're not getting all the data that's really out there. As I mentioned, hanging in harnesses is kind of a matter of technique. And when you're hanging in a sternal attachment or even a waist attachment, but really a sternal attachment is what we use the most, you're kind of sitting back, kind of like you're in a chair. Your harness kind of picks up your legs a little bit, and you're literally sitting there, and you can move around. So, are you motioning? Oh, oh wow, where did the time go? So when you're sitting in your harness, you kind of have a comfortable position, and your stuff's in front of you. People say, well, if you fall, don't you fall down and then your stuff comes up and whaps you in the face? Well, not really, because the way physics normally works is that if you pull me right here, my head's going to come back, isn't it? So if I have a harness on and I'm clipped in with a connector into a sternal attachment point, when I fall, my head's actually going to go back. What about the whiplash effect? There is a whiplash effect associated with a fall, but the whiplash effect associated with a fall in the frontal attachment point is actually less because that point is lower. When you're in a dorsal attachment point, you fall usually in that head down position, and the whiplash effect is actually greater because of the momentum that occurs with the body, because the body has to upright itself. And so even though you're attached back here, what goes forward must come back. And so it goes forward first, and then it comes back. And so so you have much more of a whiplash effect. But most importantly, and I believe that this is the critical thing, who's tried to rescue themselves or self-rescue out of a dorsal attachment point? If you put anybody to work at height, and if you employ these kinds of techniques for other people in your organization, I would implore you to please go out and try to self-rescue from that dorsal attachment point so that you know what you're putting your guys into. Because that dorsal attachment point, when you're attached to it, after you've fallen, this is no injury, you know, an injury is notwithstanding. Once you're hanging in that dorsal attachment point, you're turtled. You really are. Your diaphragm's compressed. Your arms out here and your stuff's back there. There's really not much you can do from that position. It is possible to self-rescue, especially if you're young and fit and male. We do teach people in every class that I teach that does fall protection, because OSHA requires fall protection and because it's defined as a dorsal attachment point, I teach people that method. You have to use fall protection. But everybody that puts a fall protection harness on in my facility has to know how to self-rescue, because you don't last very long in that position. Yes, sir?
You might have already covered it, but say you have a fall and you're just waiting for a rescue. Is there any hints or helpful things that you should do while you're waiting for a rescue?
Absolutely. And that's a really good question that I hadn't covered. Thank you for bringing it up. Anything that you can do to get that pressure off your diaphragm is a good thing. You see, there's suspension trauma relief straps that are available these days. They attach to your harness, and you just deploy them. They're basically an atria or some webbing with a loop in the bottom of it. You deploy it, and you can actually stand up in it. Again, think about physics. When you have something attached to your harness and you step into it, it's not all that convenient because you're kind of pulling yourself like this. But it's better than nothing at all. If you can get that suspension trauma relief strap back here somehow so that it's standing or so that it's so that when you step up in it, you're actually standing on your system rather than on yourself, it's much more effective. Yes, sir? That's right. There are some that actually have the lanyard that come out of the deceleration, out of the shock absorber. When it blows, the little foot loop falls out, and all you have to do if you're a scuba diver is like, find in your you have to kind of reach around and find it. But you can reach around and find it and step up into it. So anything you can do to release that. I'm sorry? Injuries notwithstanding. Absolutely. Injuries notwithstanding. And that's so critical because, again, if you've ever taken a fall into that kind of a harness, you know, again, people say, well, what about slamming your face with all your gear? I think that's a much less of a problem than actually if I'm attached here and I'm near a structure. When I fall, it's going to pile drive my head into whatever's nearby. So injuries notwithstanding. Again, an advantage of rope access is the extensive training these technicians have to go through. The level one technician has a minimum of 40 hours training. They're certified by a third-party evaluator. Depending on what country they're in, there are usually different standards or different regulations that they go by. In the United States, there's an organization called the Society of Professional Rope Access Technicians, and they do most of the certifications in the United States, although there is another organization called IRATA, the Industrial Rope Access Trade Association from England, that does a lot of certifications here as well because of the oil rigs here in the United States. So there's three levels of skill, level one, level two, level three. With the increasing levels of skill, they have increased levels of training. Each level has to be evaluated independently by a third-party evaluator and requires a certain number of work hours before you can progress. If you don't do a minimum of, I think it's 500 hours a year, you lose your certification and you have to retest and be evaluated again. So it's a pretty stringent, strict kind of thing. But again, these workers are able to do a whole lot more than your typical fall arrest, person in fall arrest. So I would encourage you to consider rope access because it does make access and protection more feasible in a variety of environments. It encourages the use of proper equipment because of the extensive training that these people have, and it facilitates prompt rescue because they can rescue themselves and one another. Looking at fall incident rates, we don't have a whole lot of data from the United States. As I said, the SIC codes just aren't there for rope access or many other things yet. But if you look at the rate per 100,000 workers, there was a research study done in the UK where they've been doing rope access, and actually they do record rope access separately from other types of falls. And the incident rate per 100,000 workers is a 1.3 or 3.38 if you expand it over a 10-year period. 20-year period, sorry. Anyway, compared to 253 falls in the United States in 2008, 80 falls to a lower level in the United States in 2008, and with rope access, it's 1.3 incidents per 100,000 workers. That wasn't even falls to a lower level. That was just cuts and things.
These must be fatal falls.
No, actually, the U.S. falls are fatal falls. The rope access is kind of skewed because there were no fatal falls, so it's all incidents. And that study is actually available on the web. It's actually published by the Health and Safe HSE, our version of OSHA, in the UK. So rope access is used by a huge variety of types of industries in a variety of different kinds of environments. Rope access workers are certified here in the United States in every state to do almost any kind of work. If you're going to use rope access, we don't really have any existing standards in the United States for rope access as yet. It is briefly mentioned in ANSI Z359.2, which is the Managed Fall Protection Plan. There is a new chapter of ANSI Z359.8 that's in development for rope access and to address rope access specifically. There is a brief ASTM document, whose number I can't remember, I'm sorry, off the top of my head, but it's published by the EO6 Buildings Committee. And it does pertain specifically to rope access, although it's more of a guide and it's pretty short. It's not as detailed as the point 8 is going to be. But because we don't have a lot of existing standards out there as yet for rope access, the best thing that you can do and the first place that you really want to look is to industry standards, you want to develop SOPs for your own company, and you want to go to industry best practice, which is essentially the most commonly accepted methodologies for using that kind of work. There's an organization I mentioned earlier called the Society of Professional Rope Access Technicians. I am the regulatory assistance chair at the moment for that organization, but it's an organization here in the United States that is comprised of rope access employers, workers, suppliers, anybody who's interested in rope access, basically. And there are thousands of certified rope access technicians through SPRAT. SPRAT has two documents available that are industry consensus documents. Industry consensus means that a specific industry got together and wrote a standard. It's not an ANSI standard, but it is industry consensus. So all the people in that organization and related organizations got together, wrote standards, validated them just like they do in ANSI, voted on them just like they do in ANSI, addressed negatives just like they do in ANSI, and came out with these documents. Safe practices for rope access work is guidance on acceptable practices and thought processes and procedures for rope access that is available for free download on the web. And certification requirements for rope access work tells you what a person needs to be capable of doing in order to be certified, so during their test. That also is available for free download on the web. Training is not required for rope access technicians to actually go through the certification, but I can promise you, you can't pass the certification test without training. So it's not a... The Society of Professional Rope Access Technicians strives to not be a vehicle for the promotion of training or for the promotion of any training organization. There are dozens of training organizations out there that will do the work, and they're listed on SPRAT. But SPRAT doesn't say you have to have X number of hours of training. SPRAT says you have to be able to perform these skills, and a third party, somebody who's not affiliated with your company, somebody who didn't train you, somebody who has no dog in the hunt as far as whether you pass or not, has to evaluate you and test you, and it's a full-day evaluation, plus a written test, and it's extremely rigorous, and you can't pass it without being trained. In order to progress to multiple levels or in order to maintain your certification, as I say, there is a requirement for a minimum number of hours worked. The safe practices document kind of outlines the work permit or the work plan process. It basically calls for trained certified technicians. It tells you that you need to identify the work methods that you're going to use, identifying the work team, what equipment you're going to use. It talks about your JHA and JSA, talks about your PPE, talks about anchors, public safety, and rescue emergency response. Those are the things that the Safe Practices document will guide you through. This is a job that was actually done by Vertical Access Technologies, probably a building that you recognize. Another building that's very difficult to do any other way. Erecting a scaffold or any other kind of system on this building would be very hazardous in that it would shut the building down for extended periods of time. It would be an eyesore, and it would just be very difficult to do for practical reasons as far as what you can and can't reach. You may be able to see a rope access technician hanging off the left-hand side of the structure. Zooming in a little bit, you can see there's actually three rope access technicians up there. You can see that they've had a hard time finding anchors, so they found one that they figured wouldn't move. And that's kind of what the system looks like. So rope access, again, I would encourage you to look at it as an option for the reduced exposure that it offers. You can put fewer workers into a given facility or a given place for a whole lot less time than you can with most other methodologies. You can work in extreme environments with minimal impact. You can see this is kind of the worst of all worlds. This guy's... using a torch in a windy, salty, hazardous environment, and he's using rope access techniques. It's also very cost-effective, which is a really big deal in certain places. Trying to do work on certain structures in various industries, structures get ignored because it's expensive to maintain, and this is a relatively inexpensive, cost-effective way to do things with minimal impact to the structure. And, of course, you can do it pretty quick without a whole lot of public impact. And then finally, I'd like to talk to you about program administration. A lot of you guys are probably program administrators in here. You're probably the kind of people who would run the program if you were doing rope access or any other kind of fall protection work. For any fall protection kind of system, whether it's fall arrest, positioning, anything, rope access, the program administrator really needs to think through all of these points. Again, this is identified in ANSI Z359.2, the Managed Fall Protection Plan, and it will guide you through this process. But the program administrator really needs to identify the safety systems that are going to be used, specific equipment that's intended to be used, emergency planning in case of an accident, and then training for all of those, for the safety systems, the equipment, the planning, or for the emergency planning. And then retraining. When we train, we can't just stop. We actually have to retrain and keep our people's skills up. Evaluations and reevaluations. Often we train within our own organizations, and I highly encourage that. I think it's really good to train within your own organization because you have consistency there and you don't have some outsider telling your people something really, really weird. The problem with that, though, is that we have to avoid becoming myopic. So sending your trainers out to learn different things is a really important part of that. And possibly having people come in to evaluate your systems, your techniques, your personnel to give outside perspective on what you're doing and how you're doing it is a really good way to offset some of that myopic perspective that can occur. That's really all I have for you guys today. If you'd like to ask any questions or have anything you'd like to discuss, I'd be happy to take any questions from the floor. Okay, I will be here afterwards to chat if anybody would like to chat. I would encourage you to complete your online session evaluation form. And again, I'll be here to chat. If you'd like to chat, I've left some cards up there as well.
Thank you for listening. This concludes the session. For information regarding other sessions in this series, please call AVON at 1-800-810-TAPE.